family reunion came as the case against her began to fall apart. Do you want to take it from there and tell us what happened after that and where we're at now?
Well, obviously the case fell apart because where she was arrested and incarcerated and went through all the hassle with another eight people was on railroad property, and we found out, of course, that the city does not have jurisdiction there, and that was sort of a last-minute thing, and the judge indeed threw it out, and they wasted all of that time, assembling a jury and so on and so forth. But the other eight people, or the other seven people, ended up either spending time in jail and or fines, and as a result of that going on, and so we indeed, took a stand with Diane. Diane said, enough is enough. I'm tired of, I don't want to go to jail again, and I'm tired of being treated, like a second-class citizen only because I'm poor and have nowhere to sleep.
You know, it's interesting. If police pulled this on a person in a house and evaded or expanded beyond their jurisdiction to go in to arrest you in your house for sleeping, find you, let's say, and put you in jail, and then let's say your 67-year-old grandmother, they were going to take her into a prosecution later, and then they found, whoops, we haven't got jurisdiction, I guess we'll drop the case. There'd be civil lawsuits up the yin-yang for the other people that they had falsely imprisoned, falsely fined, and just the outrageous idea of their sending a sheriff around to harass people where there's no jurisdiction to do so is just incredible. And yet, of course, I suppose most of us, I guess Diane Grew is probably relieved to know that she wasn't being prosecuted, but I guess she's probably sleeping outside tonight, right?
Well, again, in the case of Diane Grew, she makes it. She's one of those fortunate people that does have income and does manage to make it through the month, in spite of the fact that Buena Park City has tried to drive them away even in that respect, because, in essence, what she does is by having a certain amount of income, she can stay in the motels by the week and so forth. But she doesn't have enough money to get an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And so she ends up toward, the end of the week.
End of the month?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
without any lodging.
Without any lodging, and so she comes here, and of course the other people. But we're still getting some harassment here from the police.
And here, of course, is your church,
yeah.
The First Baptist Church.
Hello.
Hello? You still there?
Yeah, no, hang on just a second.
Okay. And we're talking to Reverend Wiley.
Okay, I'm back. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So we are still,
by and large, we get a lot of cooperation from the police department, but it's a small handful that just absolutely, set about when they got nothing else to do and the donuts are stale and they decide to go out and harass some homeless people.
Now, you actually have how many people in your church now?
We have about 200 people sleeping here every night.
That's a violation of a court order. I'm calling the judge.
Yeah, I guarantee you he knows that.
In fact, you're allowed to have only 52 people or something in your church?
Yeah, 52. And I've also...
You should be billing the city for this stuff. You're putting up 150 people that the city need to be sheltering, right?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And if they'd have spent the $500,000 that they spent prosecuting me, they could have built a shelter.
It's so much more fun to prosecute you.
Oh, absolutely. And I've now been kicked out of the North Orange County Court. We have several districts here in Orange County. We have the North Court, Central Court, South Court, and West Court. And North Court is sort of where we're in their jurisdiction primarily, mm-hmm. and because most of Buena Park and most of Anaheim is in North Orange County Court District. And when I went up there broadcasting my little radio show over a cell phone and got caught in the hallway because I was saying that on my radio show we happened to be discussing that day a case where the jury members could vote their conscience.
Jury nullification.
Mm-hmm. And of course, boy, did I ever stir up a hornet's nest then. The judge arrested me, drugged me into his courtroom, violated all my constitutional rights, then banned me from the courtroom, and then later issued an order saying that I had to completely stay away not only from his courtroom but out of the courthouse. So I've been kicked out of the North Court courthouse itself, and we decided we weren't going to stand for that, and so we said, okay, we'll just bypass everything. We went straight to federal court. We filed a $2 million lawsuit against the judge and against the court.
This is John Alexander, your attorney?
No. I just did it myself.
Uh-huh.
And with the help of a paralegal. And we filed a federal lawsuit in the federal court here in the Central District here in Los Angeles, and they put it on the fast track. Boy, I tell you, when we put that thing in the front door, it slid out the back door before we knew what was going on.
Wow. So
they put it on the fast track. Within about 3 weeks, it was over and done. The judges sent out an edict saying that they told us probably what their decision was going to be, and then they did give the decision, and basically they handed out a decision that a judge is immune from prosecution. You cannot prosecute, you cannot sue a judge.
Wow, bulletproof vest.
Bulletproof judges, yeah, so right. We can't sue them. So we lost in federal court. We were going to take it to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeal, but, you know, those guys all play golf together, so it would have been just another expense of time and so forth to do it, because they would stick together. They're going to cover each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I know that jury nullification is something we've worked on here in Santa Cruz around the drug war and around the laws against the homeless, and also when there have been anti-war protesters whose rights have been violated. That, of course, is the basic proposition that a jury can make a decision both on the law and on the facts in any case, regardless of what the judge tells them.
Yeah. Well, that's the history in this nation. There's all kinds of precedent for it. And in fact, I'll just quote for you what I was kicked out of the courthouse over. Let me get back here to it. And this is an exact quote of what I was quoting on my radio station over the telephone, just like I would be doing right now. And here's what I said. Quote, "The jury has a right to judge both the law as well as the fact in the controversy." That was John Jay, the first seated Supreme Court justice mm-hmm. in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I quote, "The jury has a right to determine both the law and the facts." That's Samuel Chase, U.S. Supreme Court justice, and also a signer of the Unanimous Declaration. And then I also quoted Oliver Wendell Holmes, and he said, "The jury has the power to bring a verdict in the teeth of both law and fact." And then I quoted Harlan F. Stone, the 12th Chief Justice in the United States. "The law itself is on trial quite as much as the cause which is to be decided." And then I also quoted a case, U.S. versus Daugherty, 473F, second, and so forth. Quote, "The pages of history shine on instances of the jury's exercise of its prerogative to disregard instructions of the judge." And those five quotations got a court order, got me arrested, a court order issued, and I cannot even walk in that courthouse now, and the federal court upheld it.
These are hard times, Wiley.
Oh, yeah, and they're getting tougher as time goes on. And then on September the 19th, I was in Washington, D.C. I had been there for a meeting. We take a group of leaders, pastors and leaders, to a congressional prayer meeting in Washington, D.C. once a year. We had spent one day in the House, one day in the Senate, and on the 19th of September, just 8 days past September the 11th, we were in the United States Supreme Court in the hallway of the courthouse, and we were touring it as Christians, and I was encouraging people to pray for the judges, and I was told by the Capitol Police, "You cannot pray in this building." And I said, "The heck I can't."
This
and
is no school
down.
Room.
At that time, I wasn't praying on my knees nor with my eyes closed, but because they made an issue of it, I did. I dropped to my knees along with about six or eight other fellas and ladies, and we dropped to our knees and began to pray audibly with our eyes closed and our hands folded in what I call the George Washington Valley Forge position, and they kicked us out of the courthouse. So now I have been banned not only from a local court, but from the highest court in the land, from the United States Supreme Court.
I think you sound like a terrorist prayer there, Wiley.
Hey, you say that tongue-in-cheek, but you know what? One of the big criterias under a thing called Project Megiddo now is that if you believe in the second coming of Christ, you are on the terrorist list.
Because of connections with so-called right-wing nativist, what do you call them, Aryan
yep.
groups?
And militias
yeah.
and
right.
and a lot of other things. And there's two things that are going to, if you go to the FBI, and if you are a Christian or an activist, either or both, and I happen to sort of fit in both those categories,
mm-hmm.
if you are a Christian or an activist and you happen to be against certain things that the FBI and the government don't like, your name automatically goes under Project Megiddo. It's strange that they would use a biblical term to delineate it, but that if you are indeed, if you're opposed to the New World Order, then you're a terrorist. If you're opposed to abortion, you're a terrorist. If you indeed are a believer in the second coming of Jesus Christ, literally to this earth, then you are also listed by the FBI as a terrorist.
So you probably made a few of those lists now, Wiley.
Most of them.
I think I made a few lists for other reasons.
Yeah.
I think on the left they're giving you if you're a strong environmentalist or if you work with Food Not Bombs, you can also be considered to be a terrorist.
That's right.
And of course you have the situation where you don't have to just be a foreign national to worry about secret military tribunals, but you know you can have your email raided, your communications with your attorney watched. Your funds seized just for associations with groups that, for all you know, were simply charity groups, like the largest Islamic charity group in this country. It's had its assets frozen, as you probably know.
Yeah, and can I tell you another catch-22 situation that mm-hmm. this new Patriot Act has put us in?
Mm-hmm.
The Patriot Act says, as you've just delineated, that if you donate money to an organization who has ever given money to a terrorist organization, then you too are guilty of donating money and can be arrested. Well, if you paid income tax, you indeed donated to a terrorist organization.
The major terrorist organization.
Well, and legally so, because at one time, the U.S. government has never denied this, at one time the U.S. government was giving money to the Taliban.
Oh, they funded Osama bin Laden.
They funded Osama bin Laden. They funded him. So as a taxpayer, when you pay your taxes to the U.S. government, you're giving money to an organization that funded a terrorist organization. Therefore, you're in violation of the U.S. Patriot Act.
Right. Plus, of course, the fact that the U.S. has done its own independent terrorist activities for years.
Oh, yeah.
At least some of us, you know, we count the activities of the Contras, of the Savimbi and
mm-hmm.
Angola, and, you know, different groups throughout this country, throughout the world that are funded by... Well, the CIA and the U.S. government, as you know, they engage in mass shootings of civilians, torture, things of that sort. We're talking with Wiley Drake, who is a pastor of, give me the exact name of your church.
First Southern Baptist Church of Buena Park, California.
Excellent. And what's happening down there at Christmas? I know that we've heard some wonderful Christmas gifts that Buena Park has had for its homeless, like you can't stay for more than 30 days in a motel.
Yeah, they've done that. They've done the 30-day motel routine so that if homeless people manage to get on their feet at all and are able to stay in a motel for a few weeks, then at the end of 29 days they have to be booted out, and there's no way to get around that. They've changed their laws. We have some anti-whistling laws here in town that they can get you on as well.
Anti-whistling laws?
Yes. That's on the
terrorist
book.
Whistling?
you know, if you go to Ripley's, believe it or not, or you go to the jousting, we have live jousting here in Buena Park, dinner theater and Wild West show,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of sing-along, and people come out singing, and if it's past 10 o'clock and you're whistling when you come out or singing, they can arrest you for whistling or singing in public. And
has that actually happened recently?
It has not happened recently, but the law was changed recently
mm-hmm.
because the old law wasn't stiff enough, because the law said that the officer had to use a decibel meter to determine whether you were too loud or not. And on his way out, just before Herr Richard T. Fink, the chief of police, asked the city council to change that law, and now it says what a reasonable man, i.e. an officer, would determine is too loud is good enough. They don't have to have a decibel meter.
I see.
So they set these laws up, and they in many cases do not use them. Let me give you another one. For example, they just passed recently, and they got people. It was called the Owning Act, and that's where you could not put an awning up in your front or side yard. And they said, well, you don't want your property values to go down. You don't want some, you know, trailer trash living next door to you putting up an old blue tarp on the front porch or on the side of his garage and causing the property values to go down. And that's okay. But what if you're driving a Mercedes and you don't have a garage to put it in and you put a car cover on it? A car cover would pass as a violation of the Owning Act. The only place you can have any kind of tent or awning on your property in the city of Buena Park is in the backyard. If you do it on the side yard or the front yard, you're in violation of the code.
Well, at Santa Cruz, we do you one better. You can have a person sleep in your backyard, but you put him in your side yard or your front yard, if it's visible from the street, you can be charged with a violation.
Yeah, I'm sure that would be the same thing here, too.
Well, the other thing I guess I wanted to bring to your attention was there was a great success in Santa Barbara, and I've mentioned this in the last show here on Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, that the local district, not the district attorney, the former public defender, Glenn Maurer, has been using the necessity defense to defend homeless people who are arrested for sleeping or camping. That is to say, the argument that, yeah, they were camping, yeah, they were sleeping, yeah, maybe the law is constitutional, which it isn't in my view.
Yeah.
But they had to do it because they had no alternatives, and they were trying to avoid a greater evil. And he's been successful. He recently had a decision 5 days ago that upheld the necessity defense in two cases. In particular, in a case which said that these folks had the choice of going into a church where they would have to engage in certain religious ceremonies and practices mm-hmm. that they may not agree with.
Sure.
These were people who were being removed from their vehicle. They had a vehicle, they were parked legally on the streets, but they were sleeping in the vehicle, and they were told by the police they had to go to this church. And the decision was, no, they don't have to do that. That's a violation of their First Amendment right. I mean, you can go to church if you want to go to church.
They can't force you.
They can't force you to go to church. I mean, you know, if you're a Roman Catholic and you're in a Baptist church, you might not go for the ceremony and vice versa, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that that's a very positive ruling. And the second ruling indicates that that housing in a vehicle is, that's really what it is. That in Santa Barbara, the crisis is such that they're really dealing with housing. That a vehicle has become the only real affordable housing for poor people is a vehicle. So if they are in their vehicle, it says that it would in essence recognize that you have to acknowledge their vehicle is housing itself, and so in order to get them out of their vehicle, you have to do things like apply housing law, which has to do with evictions and has a whole different process of protections. And this has only been upheld on a local level by the court judge and then by the appeals judges. But if it's a published opinion, we're still waiting to see if it's going to be published, it'll have an impact down in Buena Park as well.
Sure, absolutely. Now, who was the attorney again?
The attorney was a man named Glenn Maurer, Mowrer. And what I'll do is I'll give you his number off air after we finish this interview. I'm going to play a little music.
I'd love to
quickly.
Get that because I'd like to talk to him and have my... Because see, when in my case, I was charged with five criminal misdemeanors, found guilty of four, and most of the jury members said if we could have had the necessity defense, they would have found me not guilty, but the judge would not allow my lawyer to use the necessity defense.
And you, of course, are referring to the cases where you had people living in the church and the city was trying to use a number of zoning ordinances to hassle you to get the...
Well, it was part of zoning, but basically what it was boiled down to is the conditional use permit, and they said I changed the use of the building and so forth, and so that's what they used. They basically threatened, said, if you don't kick these homeless people out of here, we're going to use these against you, and they did, and I was found guilty. Because I was guilty of letting people sleep in my church, and the jury said, you know, hey, it doesn't take us long to determine, but Pastor Drake's never denied it. In fact, he's been on the news media talking about it and bragging about the fact that they're helping people by letting them sleep in their church, and so we were going to prevent the necessity or present the necessity that these people were there, and I broke the law because there was nowhere else to send them.
Actually,
there was none.
We're going to actually have on the air Peter Marin, who's also an activist and writer from Santa Barbara, has been involved with the Committee for Social Justice in Santa Barbara. He should be on the air next Thursday, sometime between 6 and 8 in the evening when we do our show, and you'll be able to catch it on that on the www.microradio.net/FRSC, the email, I should say, the website address for free radio. We're talking with Wiley Drake, who's a pastor in Buena Park, and you're persona non grata in the courts. You're a big lawbreaker by stuffing your church with homeless people. What else have you been up to?
Well, that.
Oh, you're praying around the Supreme Court.
I prayed in the Supreme Court, so now I'm a terrorist because I prayed in the Supreme Court.
Terrorist pastor prays at Supreme Court.
Yeah,
I've heard of it.
I've been kicked out of the Supreme Court, been kicked out of the highest court of the land, but I have been invited to the presidential prayer breakfast coming up in February.
This could be a real. Now, if you start praying there, you might actually be. be jumped by the Secret Service.
Yeah. Well, this is supposed to be a prayer breakfast, so hopefully they'll at least let us pray. But we'll see how that works. And we're also going to go back to Washington twice this year. We're going to go two times in 2002. And if anybody would like to go with us, it does have a religious flavor, and we certainly want everybody to know about that, because it is a meeting of congressional men and women who believe in, you know, God. And but we do meet in the House one day, and in the Senate, and in the U.S. Supreme Court. Although I probably won't be able to make that meeting, I'll make.
You better
the other
keep
meeting.
Your Bible under wraps.
Yeah, do it undercover or something. Right. Go incognito. But if anyone's interested, they can reach us at pastorsprayer.net. On the World Wide Web, pastorsprayer.net, and they can see all the information about that. And we'd love, it's a do-it-yourself, it's not, we're not raising money, we're not, you know, we don't do any, you know, fundraising or anything. It's just basically a time. All we do is we get a conference hotel close to D.C., you know, and you don't even have to stay at that same hotel, but we do get a conference hotel, meet on one night, and then we go to the House, the Senate, and Supreme Court.
Are you going to fund the trip back there? Are you?
Oh, no. This is all a do-it-yourself thing. Everybody gets your own airplane tickets and everything.
Just make sure that your Bible doesn't have any any secret weapons or anthrax hidden inside it there.
Got to make sure it doesn't have anything packed inside of it or anything.
Don't have a copy of that subversive Constitution document either. I don't. You know, we were trying to do away with the Constitution.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, if the United Nations gets its way, they will.
We got Bush. We don't need the United Nations. He's doing.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk some sense into that man.
And they're also trying to now rewrite the Ten Commandments for the United Nations to accept. So.
Wow, well, that's another story. We've been talking with Wiley Drake, and Wiley, I guess what I'm going to do is I'm going to hang on here for a minute while I kind of do some more introductions, and we'll have a chat off air briefly. And for those who are interested in getting in touch with Wiley, how can they reach you?
Well, they can reach us several ways. Number one, telephone number 714-522-7201. They can reach me, Wiley Drake, at Hotmail. That's WileyDrake at Hotmail.com. Or they can reach us at pastorsprayer.net on the World Wide Web, pastorsprayer.net.
And if you've not had time to write any of those down, you can give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I will pass those on to you. Wiley, thank you very much for being with us, and hang tough here for a minute.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Denny, Failure to Disperse, one of my favorite albums. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, or on the web, www.microradio.net/FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Call in. We have open phone lines, 427-3772, 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Well, we just had a rather long all-over-the-map conversation with Wiley Drake, pastor of Buena Park. And I was actually, before that conversation began, I was reading a story about Diane Grew, who was charged under the anti-camping law down there in Santa Ana, Fullerton, Buena Park area, all of them kind of, I guess, adjoining suburbs or relatively near to each other. Santa Ana is a kind of an interesting city area because out of Santa Ana have come numerous homeless cases which have provided the backbone of this necessity defense that is now has a real chance of overturning camping bans, at least in California and possibly in other states too. The necessity defense, I actually can kind of want to run through it for those of you who you probably have heard about it, but you haven't maybe heard specifically about it lately. Of course, I have to fumble with my papers to get the proper, and here we are. Necessity defense has six elements, and this essentially, as I was saying to Wiley, you admit that you indeed committed a crime, that is, there you did so beyond a reasonable doubt, that it's been proven, that the law itself isn't necessarily unconstitutional, it may well be a valid law for some people or in some circumstances, but in this case, in your particular circumstances, you prove six elements: that you prevented a significant evil, that you had no adequate alternative, that you did not create a greater danger than the one you avoided, that you had a good faith belief that what you were doing was necessary, that such belief you had was objectively reasonable, and you did this in a situation where you did not substantially contribute to the circumstances of the emergency or necessity. Those are the six elements of the necessity defense, People versus Pepper, 1996, and actually Henry Eichhorn, the Eichhorn case, which we used here in Santa Cruz in the Camp Paradise trial and is now being appealed because Commissioner Joseph found against us, found there was no necessity, even though he could not state what the alternatives were to camping by the riverside. He didn't have any other alternatives for folks. There was no other shelter, but he magically decided that they somehow should create other alternatives somehow, somewhere, some way. But that's not really what the necessity defense says. I mean, it really looks like a real it's a strong prospect for forcing jurisdictions, gentrifying authorities and local cities that want to run homeless people out or run them into hiding places, that they're going to have to contend with basic human rights issues. Admittedly, not in the same form that perhaps some of us would have preferred. I mean, some of us believe that these very laws, you shouldn't have to show that you had to do this in any one particular case, but that the laws themselves are unconstitutional. That, you know, an example would be if there's a law against having black people in a certain part of town, where you can show, well, I had to be there because I had no place else to be. Maybe I was ill, maybe I was sick, and so forth. Why should you have to prove that? The law that homeless people or black people are illegal in some areas is ridiculous, and it has to be illegal. It has to be unconstitutional the law that states that homeless people cannot sleep legally at night. That is something that, to me, is pretty self-evident, and a lot of lawyers apparently spend a lot of time trying to run around that particular basic deal, just as people try to run around basic civil rights for black people, basic civil rights for women, basic civil rights for gay people, basic civil rights for fundamentalists. I don't care. You got to have basic civil rights, and that's what we don't have here in Santa Cruz for poor people. Phone lines are open in case you want to join this discussion, 427-3772, 427-3772. So, we've got about half an hour left in the show, and I guess I'll finish reading this about the Diane Grew case, so I guess some of the tension and suspense is gone, because we know that Grew was not just acquitted, all charges were dropped, because it turned out that it was a bogus raid to begin with. They were raiding property they had no right to be on. The police were raiding Caltrans property, state property, not local property. And apparently been doing did so with impunity and sent other people to jail and without any apologies. That's the authorities down there. In the early 1990s, Santa Ana officials aggressively tried to rid the Civic Center area of hundreds of homeless people who had created a tent city, confiscating transients' bedrolls and arresting 64 people for littering, jaywalking, and urinating in public. Some of the homeless sued, winning about $450,000 in damages. The city changed its strategy in 1992 when the city council unanimously passed a citywide camping ban, an ordinance fought in the courts by advocates for the homeless, but supported by 90 other cities and counties as it wound its way through the court system. This was what I call the Seven Cities camping ordinance trial that we fought in the early 90s unsuccessfully. We were stymied by the state Supreme Court in the Tobe decision. The California Supreme Court ruled in 1995 that the camping law was constitutional and falls within the city's police power. Since then, there have not been the same kind of homeless problems near the Civic Center. Santa Ana City Attorney Joseph Fletcher said, though authorities occasionally ticket transients for camping in public places. The number of people living on the streets in Orange County has increased. A recent study pegs the number on any given night at 19,000, an 8% increase from last year, Roper said. An estimated 14,000 of these are families with children. There are 2,197 shelter beds in the county, even though GRU was facing a maximum sentence of 1 year in jail and a $2,000 fine if convicted. Her situation may be looking up. Last year, she began receiving $400 a month more for a disability and is considering renting a room somewhere. I think about it all the time, but I don't know where I want to go, she said. In the meantime, she's been staying in her attorney, Dana Point, home. Her attorney is Dana Point home. Staff writer Teresa Sloan contributed to the story. And the anti-camping ordinance is, it is unlawful for any person to camp, occupy camp facilities, or use camp paraphernalia in or on any street or any public parking lot or public area, improved or unimproved, except as otherwise provided by law. Notice the word sleeping, Santa Cruz City Council, does not appear in that law. It is unlawful for any person to store personal property, including camp facilities and camp paraphernalia, in any park, public street, public parking lot, or any other public property, improved or unimproved, except as otherwise provided by law. Whoops, it looks like I spoke too soon. Sleeping in vehicles on public property. It shall be unlawful as of January 1997 for any person to sleep in any vehicle on any publicly owned property in the city at any time between dusk and dawn the next day, except as hereinafter provided. This shall not apply to any person while driving, stops on public property, including any street, to sleep due to becoming too tired to drive safely. In such event, however, it shall be unlawful for any driver to sleep in his or her vehicle on such public property for more than two consecutive hours. There is no such exception in Santa Cruz. It's illegal to sleep after 11 o'clock at night in a vehicle, period. And on the UC campus, it's illegal to sleep after dusk, period. No exceptions. And finally, there was this story on August 9th, and I was reading some of it when Wiley Drake called in. The first homeless camping case to reach a local court in years seemed to be derailed by evidence GRU was not camping on public property after all. Nearly 9 months after her arrest, things were looking up for the 66-year-old former maid and factory worker. This is a real shock, GRU said, when her granddaughter, great-grandson, and former daughter-in-law, Shirley Johnson of Hesperia, turned up in the hallway. I didn't know nothing about anything, Johnson said. Her family learned of GRU's plight Wednesday morning after reading the register. She said she immediately packed up her two youngest children and jumped in the car for the 90-minute trek. I came to get her, Johnson said, before they sent her up the river. I want to know she has someplace to go. GRU said she was a bit overwhelmed and didn't know if she would take up Johnson on her offer. I don't know anything right now, said GRU, who's been on the streets for 10 years. I might be going to jail for 6 months. GRU is charged with two misdemeanor counts of violating Buena Park's anti-camping laws. She was arrested November 25th last year as she sat in a lawn chair along the railroad tracks off the Santa Ana I-5 freeway. It was her sixth arrest in 5 years, or in 2 years. The prosecution appeared to be the first in Orange County since a 1995 crackdown on homeless-related offenses. On Wednesday, defense lawyer John Alexander presented a letter from Union Pacific Railroad Company and argued GRU was arrested on railroad property. Superior Court Judge James Marion said that could be an insurmountable problem, apparently it was, for the prosecution when the trial resumes. I think I'm going to tell the jury that if they think it's private property, they can't convict her, Marion said. If it's private property, she's not guilty. After court, City Prosecutor Greg Palmer said Measurements taken Wednesday afternoon showed the defense was right. Still, he plans to argue that Buena Park has jurisdiction. Whether it's public or private property, it's still a public area, Palmer said. If the case is thrown out, Palmer said he'll recommend the city rewrite its laws to clearly include areas like the one in question. He said the case was never really about GRU. Both sides are looking at a bigger picture, Palmer said. He recalled Santa Ana's Civic Center, which attracted homeless people in the early 1990s until the anti-camping laws were upheld. And Palmer said he was happy to see GRU's family step up to assist her. If I lose this case because of a technicality and my bringing it has the effect of reuniting her with her family that can help her, then we're winners, Palmer said. Johnson said she thinks the case against her former mother-in-law is ridiculous, and she hopes GRU will move in with her. She's got family here, Johnson said. She's got babies to enjoy. That's from an August issue of the Orange County Register about Diane GRU down in Buena Park, California. Apparently, she's occasionally staying at Wiley Drake's church, and I'm not sure if she's taken up lodging with her daughter-in-law. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Our phone lines are 427-3772, in case you want to give us a call. I also wanted to kind of spend a little time, we've got about 15 minutes left, discussing with any of you out there who have some thoughts or ideas, what your concerns are about how City Council has been behaving in terms of, well, its decorum, its process, its openness to suggestions, the way it treats people who speak at the mic, the rules that former mayor Tim Fitzmaurice set down, actually some procedures that were used previously by Mayor Sugar, even the year before Fitzmaurice was in office. Now, of course, we have a new mayor, Mayor Christopher Crone, and I myself have a number of concerns I'm going to bring to his attention when I meet with him on Thursday, in the hopes that I can get him to liberalize, actually restore, some of the more liberal procedures that were used before Fitzmaurice took office. And here are some of my ideas, and maybe you can give me reactions to them if anyone out there is listening and wishes to share his thoughts here. The public is almost invariably limited to 3 minutes in any discussion, and also there's very little opportunity for interchange between members of the public and members of the City Council, unless the City Council members choose to interrupt members of the public and denounce them or contradict them or ask questions of them. But members of the public aren't able, after their little brief public hearing time, to contribute to the debate or discussion, even if wholly new issues come up, for example, that weren't previously, the public previously wasn't aware were being discussed at all, and so couldn't have given oral communication on or public comment on. I mean, this, for example, was the case with the safe sleeping zones. In 2000, a year ago, there was an agenda item that was titled Motion to Bring Up the Second Reading of the Safe Sleeping Zones Item in 2 weeks. And that meant that it couldn't have been brought up that day because what was agendized as coming up in 2 weeks, that was going to be discussed. Well, at 1:30 in the morning, Catherine Byers put forward a special recommendation that not that it be agendized in 2 weeks or not be agendized in 2 weeks, but that it be completely eliminated from the agenda entirely, that the safe sleeping zones matter be essentially dropped completely. And this was a violation of the Brown Act, in my view, the Public Meetings Act, because members of the community, had they known that somebody was going to try to simply eliminate this whole thing, had that been on the agenda, that would have been something that people might have wanted to talk about. They didn't know that it was coming up. All they knew was coming up was it going to be happening in 2 weeks or later, was really some of the issue at hand. And instead, Catherine Byers came up with a special resolution at 1 in the morning, when there were only 4 of us in the room. And actually, I was removed from the chambers by force. I was objecting to something else. Mayor Sugar, or I believe it was Vice Mayor Fitzmaurice at that time, were interrupting another speaker as she tried to make some points, and I considered it to be another violation of the Brown Act, which is that the public has the right to speak without interruption from the City Council. Mostly the City Council gets huge amounts of time to speak. At the state and national legislature, you're limited in the amount of time you can spend, even as a legislator speaking. But in the Santa Cruz City Council, you can go on all night. But, of course, you can make sure that nobody else gets to respond to you. And That's one of the things I'm going to be talking about with Mayor Crone, asking him to expand oral communication and public comment time, and also to contract city council discussion time. They should have a fairly limited amount of time to speak on items and not be able to go on about it all day and all night. And there should be, I think, second periods of public comment if, you know, new material is brought up, or even if the discussion evolves to a different point. So issues I'm going to raise have to do with censoring of the content of public speech at the mic. So, for example, when I used the word flunky, I was told by Mayor Fitzmaurice, when he was mayor, that I would be essentially barred from speaking or arrested or removed from the chambers or asked to step away from the mic if I used that word again. Now, I didn't walk up to the city council and start spitting at them, "You dirty flunkies, you." No, I described some of the appointees of city council members, one in particular, as a flunky, and that was my opinion. I was referring, I believe, to some Citizens Police Review Board appointees who are a completely useless fig leaf board that city council uses to cover its ass and not do anything about police abuses. And the police, you know, these people who are appointed do exactly the same. And the way Mayor Crone has not appointed anybody, he's actually had no appointee for about 2 years. Sandy Brown has been missing her meetings and eventually just sort of resigned, I think, 3 or 4 or 5 months ago. But she really wasn't a member for many, many months before that in terms of any regular attendance. And Crone knew she wanted to be changed, and she kept saying, "I'm going to resign, I can't do this." And Crone is saying, "I'm going to appoint somebody," and he never did. It didn't really make a lot of difference because the board isn't doing anything. But if you had some real people on that board who were willing to use the board as a sounding board and as a platform, as a bully pulpit, and to actually make some changes, who knows, things might be different. But in any case, the question of content of speech, to use the word flunky at the mic should not be a criminal offense. To use the word Führer, which I also used, should not be a criminal, nor should it be criminal to give the Nazi salute, either from the mic or from the back of the room. It's an expression of free speech. It is not a violent piece of behavior. It is an expression of criticism. It indicates you think that the city council is behaving in a fascist-like manner. However, that's your opinion. And it seems to be actually borne out when they drag you out of the room after you've done that. But that's sort of neither here nor there. It shouldn't be criminal behavior to do that. That's going to be something I'm going to be requesting of Mayor Crone. And it hasn't been in the past. I mean, it was not under Mayor Matthews, under Mayor Rotkin, under Mayor Kennedy. Even though they did a lot of bad things in their own way, they attempted actually to stop you from naming people's names. They said it was illegal to give a city council member's name at the mic. Rotkin tried to have me arrested for that, but it was finally acknowledged that no. It's a public forum, and if you want to criticize someone, provided it's relevant to the topic at hand or you're doing so under the oral communication section, you can do that. I'm going to ask that, again, repression of silent protest in the council not be be abandoned, that the mayor stop doing things like saying, "Put down those signs in the back because you might be blocking somebody else." This is something Fitzmaurice, for the first time in history, did, with signs he didn't like, I might add, having to do with Support Camp Paradise. I was the only person being blocked, and I didn't care. But it was an opportunity for Fitzmaurice to exercise his nanny-like power, and he did so. And Susan Zeman was the woman whose sign he asked it to be lowered, and it was completely inappropriate. And Crone did exactly the same thing on December 11th when he had his first maiden voyage as mayor at city council. I believe you have to have the opportunity for silent protest at city council, particularly since you're not allowed to protest verbally. You've got to be allowed to protest silently. I've twice been removed from council chambers for, I think it was one time it was giving the Nazi salute in response to a particularly egregious bit of repression by Mayor Fitzmaurice. And then there was another time when I was giving the yakety yak symbol with my hand when Fitzmaurice was going on at great length about how wonderful Mercy Charity's housing was. And apparently Fitzmaurice and Sugar and Crone and Kennedy and Premack and Riley and Porter don't mind shuffling papers and reading and going off and getting a drink while the rest of us talk. But if we indicate expressions of even silent expressions of disbelief or skepticism or mockery as to what's going on up there, we're criminals. This is turning the democratic process on its head. And frankly, I don't expect Crone to make these kinds of changes, because I'm afraid that his conduct of the first meeting shows that he's kind of set himself on a course. But I would like to see these changes, and I would be happy to see him make these changes voluntarily, and I would commend him for them. And I think that he has to be given an opportunity to do that, and that's why I asked we have this meeting, and I told him that I'm not, you know, I know he doesn't want to talk about the sleeping ban, because, you know, we've talked about that for years, and we all know what the answer to that one is. It's just he doesn't seem to have the fortitude to do anything about it. But let's talk about some of the other issues in terms of just the decorum at City Council, so that we can actually... illegal to boo. You could applaud, but you couldn't boo. I'm sorry, that's content-based repression. I want to make sure that does not happen under the Crone regime, or at least I'd like to hear what his opinion is on that. I think oral communication should be expanded. Hence, at the last meeting, there were 23 people who wanted to speak. Christopher Crone took the trouble of counting all the people. But then he said, strangely enough, okay, everybody gets 3 minutes who can speak, and then everybody else doesn't get to speak. He made no attempt to expand oral communication at all, though he did insist on another council meeting the next day to finish other business. So he could have had expanded oral communication. People could have been allowed to speak at the only council meeting of the year. The last council meeting of the year, the only one of the month, December. There's only one council meeting in December because City Council has to go on vacation, don't you know, for Christmas, while the rest of the homeless population gets to sit outside and face $54 tickets. The Crone Council toasts itself and has Christmas turkey. And in case that sounds a little extreme, well, you just have to consider the facts as to what happens every night to 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people, and what the city law is, and what the City Council's failure to respond means for us. It means they don't care. In fact, they care to keep things the way they are. I'm also going to ask him about matters like the Mercy Charities Housing Board and boards that are supposed to be open to the public. This is the board that is, in essence, going to be spending all of our public housing money for the next decade, or certainly for the next 5 years, for this one Mercy Charities Housing project. And I actually spoke about this at the beginning of the September Redevelopment Agency meeting. I gave a little speech. I was cut short. It was a long speech. I got my 3 minutes. But it covers some of the process of what's going on there. But the real concern I have is not that I'm concerned the council's making the wrong decisions about spending $17, $18 million of public money to create less housing than it's destroying. But the way it's doing so behind closed doors is also very, very troubling, and that's something we want to see stopped. And I'd like Crone to acknowledge that if you have the Brown Act states, if you have a board set up by the City Council, funded by the City Council, with a City Council member in attendance who votes on that board, they have to have open meetings. Mercy Charities Housing doesn't have open meetings. Hasn't for 2 years. I went to one and they threw me out. Not because I was disruptive, simply because they said, we want this meeting closed. I'll play this this brief speech, and it looks like I'm not going to get any comments from you on the air, but if anybody has any thoughts and they want to present any concerns to Mayor Crone around the issues of City Council decorum and public input, I'd like to see him resume his meetings, for example. He used to have meetings with people the day before City Council. He stopped having those about a year and a half ago. Supervisors do it before every Board of Supervisors meeting. You can go to meet with your supervisor, but you can't meet with your City Council member. Give me a call at 423-4833 off-air, and I will try to get back to you. And now let's hear a little bit of the speech I gave at the City Council in September on the Mercy Charities housing issue.
Council members of the public, my name is Robert Norris. I work with HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. In the struggle ahead for affordable housing, we'll find the many millions of dollars spent with the budget still unclear on the Dolphin Lee debacle, which houses less people than before the machinations began, that ended with the tearing down of the Rex Court, seriously in jeopardy. Make no mistake, this is the urban renewal of the 21st century, with West Side gentry and genteel literature professors destroying the Hispanic community that they've promised to save. Saddest of all, of course, is the support network that elected the politicians. It's the sellout of the SCAN membership by its political figureheads and its inner circle on the issue of affordable housing. SCAN, the voting machine which brought us Rotkin, and then the supposed New Deal of Crone, Fitzmaurice, and Sugar, and finally the latest crop of forked tongues, closed eyes, and fixed smiles. Porter and Riley has not only deceived the general public, but also its own membership. Sadly, on July 24th, we heard Councilmember Porter give us his reconstructed memory of the Dolphin Lee and his sorry defense of his own surrender to the Mercy Charities housing megalith. The Dolphin Lee, as Becky Johnson pointed out, was denied as a project even as it was rammed through whole past the SCAN Housing Committee. This non-project became the only project in a surprise bushwhacking by Catherine Byers in October 1999. In the summer of 2000, it was no longer a project suddenly, so that the city could maneuver to buy the Dolphin and turn it over to Mercy Charities Housing. Were there a project, a real project at that time, would have required providing replacement housing and relocation plans, which the council's own studies showed were prohibitive in cost and produced less housing than there was before. I think Mayor Fitzmaurice or Councilmember Porter would demand clear relocation and return guarantees if their housing were being demolished for a Mercy Charities housing project. Guarantees in writing, yet they ask the Dolphin Lee community and the larger community to take on faith, but the council explicitly refuses to provide in written form. Ironically, it's not the issue of affordable housing which really divides us, but rather the determination of the council to ram through a particular pet Mercy Charities housing project without considering meaningful alternatives, cost overruns, the wishes of the residents, or the input of the community. This is the real dividing line. Worse, when challenged or questioned, the council resorts to bullying, backroom sessions, and blackballing. Council has used naked power to subvert the will of the electorate, expressed in 1998 against the BSAW plan demolition of the Dolphin. The lies began with Councilmember Sugar's repeated assurance he would not move to evict folks packed in like filthy sardines who could go back to Mexico, as he publicly put it a year ago. They denied the SCAN resolution, they killed their own tenant advisory committee, and now we have all the affordable housing money for the next 5 years tied up in a project that produces less housing than it destroys. Thank you.
Thank you. And I want to say welcome back to Mr. Norris.
Thank you.
After our long pause, I appreciate you getting me warmed up a little bit. Anyone else would like to...
And that was September meeting of City Council, actually the Redevelopment Agency, which is City Council, meeting under a sort of a different label. And Mayor Fitzmaurice, then Mayor Fitzmaurice, in an unusually benign mood after having spent 6 weeks away, recuperating perhaps. Anyway, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and this is these are the closing minutes of Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides. I have here a letter from Bernard Klitzner, which he has sent to the Santa Cruz Sentinel. I want to commend him, and I want to read it aloud. I liked it. I had some input into this letter, and, well, here it is. Hopefully it'll be showing up in the pages of your local Sentinel. Homeless people get shafted by the city's sleeping ban, anti-homeless state park restrictions, regular mall sweeps, and a bunch of fast-talking, do-nothing paper liberals on city council. Other homeless people resent seeing Camp Paradise get motel vouchers after the recent flooding. To survive, they must organize, too. Kindly Mayor Crone ignores 1,000 to 2,000 outside without shelter. Then he puts in a 15-minute guest appearance as the names of 29 dead homeless people were read at the Homeless Services Center, declaring a homeless memorial day for the survivors of his hide-out or get-out homeless policy. Calling hard-working and or disabled homeless people bums, Sentinel Letter, 1228, is like calling black people niggers, Latin people spicks, or Jewish people kikes. Homeless people will end such abuse when they camp together to secure rights and shelter, like folks at Camp Paradise have done. A Sentinel Letter writer wisely suggests City Council secure an army camp, lease city property, or fund a Service Corps program which exchanges work for lodging. That's what Camp Paradise residents and supporters have been seeking for months. Not a free ride, but a chance to earn their way while contributing to the community. Where's City Council's October 23rd evacuation plan or its alternate campsite plan for Camp Paradise? Stalled in the city manager's office. These plans could let Paradise pay its own way if it wants to. Call Council at 420-5017. Demand sleeping ban repeal and camping ban reform before more die outside. Prepare for peaceful direct action soon. And that's by Bernard Klitzner. And it looks like I've reached the end of my showtime again, as usual. I want to thank you all for listening in. Tune in again on Thursday, 6 to 8, for another edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. And check out Baker Square Huff Meeting. That's Wednesday at 8:30 in the morning, right across from Beach City Gas at Baker Square Restaurant on Ocean Street. Thanks for being with us, and I turn you now over to the vicious Vinny, who will proceed to do what he wants with you.
than washing out a roofer. We think about everything we do. Had it right here, that is gone.
Yeah! her because he wants to observe it. We sit back like they taught us. We keep quiet like they taught us. He just wants, he wants to prove it. She does nothing to remove it. We don't want anyone to mind us. We play the roles that they designed us. She does nothing to conceal it. He touches her because he wants to feel it. We blame her for being there.
Guilty! Show. You're listening to a Fugazi set here today on 96.3 FM. This is the song called Combination Lock, and it comes from 1995's Red Medicine CD. And of course, right before that, Nice New Outfit from 1991's Steady Diet of Nothing. Greed, before that, from Repeater, from 1990's Repeater CD by Fugazi. And again, off Red Medicine, we had Downed City, and then a double shot off of 1988's Seven Songs EP. We heard Suggestion and Glue Man. Right before that, off the Instrument CD released in 1999, we heard Shaken All Over, and then of course Break from 1998's End Hits, and it started off with Cash Out from their most recent release of just a few months ago, The Argument. Fugazi here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm not even supposed to be here today for the V-Man live show. It was supposed to be the Skidmark Bob live show for 30 minutes until 2, and at which point we were going to hear the weekly freak show and the scheduled rebroadcast of a classic weekly freak show from last year. Look back at the year 2000 in live music and artist interviews, performers done by Free Radio DJs, and Bob was going to put that tape on because, again, I'm not supposed to be here, but for reasons unknown to me even, I am here with you today, and I will be here for a good chunk of the afternoon, in and out, playing various things and doing live interviews. So keep it tuned now. Stand by for a classic rebroadcast of the Weekly Freak Show from last New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2000. Stay tuned to 96.3 FM, Freak Radio Santa Cruz. From the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 on the FM dial in Santa Cruz, California. It's time for the Weekly Freak Show. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this one-hour, year-end special edition of the Weekly Freak Show. On this week's program, we'll listen to the music of David Rovix, Jim Page, Phil Free, Seth, and Diane Patterson, performed live in the Freak Radio studios throughout the year 2000, and later on in the program, we'll be speaking with three members of punk band Bad Religion. Don't miss this special year-end music edition of the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next.
One to start with, but it is Free Radio Santa Cruz, so it makes sense. This is a song about a worldwide tradition that has probably been practiced somewhere in various cities around the world just in the past few hours, I imagine. And maybe it will come to your city, or probably already has.
Anybody with a cigarette lighter can do this.
It really takes very little cigarette lighter and a will to break with the heritages that we renounce.
They tried to pass an amendment in the U.S. Congress. Seems these thugs have some grievance to redress. They said we all must pledge allegiance, 'cause that is what they need. We may not desecrate their symbol of hypocrisy and greed, but the flag is just a rag. Yeah, the flag is just a rag. Just a worn-out, tired, dirty, blood-soaked rag. You can sing along with this, whether you're out there or listening to it in the future or whatever. It's all good. Just come on and sing along. pledge allegiance to the symbol. Well, how about the deed? Allegiance to democracy or blind authority. It's a flag of war from L.A. to Vietnam. It desecrates itself each time the Air Force drops a bomb. Yeah, the flag is just a rag. Oh, the flag is just a rag. Just a worn out, tired, dirty, blood-soaked rag. Like they say in Mexico, Yankee, go home. Uncle Sam and his club thinks the world's there to roam. And to make the point, well, they do the traditional thing. Light a match and let freedom ring. Cause the flag is just a rag. Yeah, the flag is just a rag. Just a worn out, tired, dirty, blood-soaked rag. Tear it up or at least hang it upside down. Tie it to your foot and drag it on the ground. Let everybody know how many lives are gone cause of idiots who said my country right or wrong. Yeah, the flag is just a rag. Oh, the flag is just a rag. Just a worn out, tired, dirty, blood-soaked rag. Yeah, the flag is just a rag. Oh, the flag is just a rag. Just a worn out, tired, dirty, blood-soaked rag.
That was David Rovix with the flag, Desecration Rag. He joined Freak Radio's Uncle Dennis on February 24th of the year 2000. You can listen to that entire show in MP3 format on the A Infos Radio Project at www.radioforall.net. Just enter a search for Earth First Radio, David Rovix Special. Jim Page was featured previously on this program in December 2000. He made an earlier appearance on Freak Radio with Eon Blues on March 25th, 2000, almost a month after the not guilty verdict in the Amadou Diallo murder trial.
Gunman walking on the side of the law, so long. you know, got a real short fuse, and that can be a fatal flaw if you fit the description. They might say you were carrying a knife onto the yellow.